If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
Jim. Got to let me go in there. Don't leave him in the hands of 20th century medicine.
Admiral, may I suggest that Dr. McCoy is correct? We must help Chekhov.
Is that the logical thing to do, Spock?
No, but it is the human thing to do.
Hello and welcome once again to The Cinephiles, where this week we are concluding our exploration of Star Trek IV: The Voyage Home. My name is Steve Morris. I'm a filmmaker and directing instructor in Los Angeles, California.
That's what you think. This is John Rocha. I am a writer, producer, and host and voiceover artist here in San Diego, California, and ready to get back aboard the Klingon ship. Yeah.
And of course, we are thrilled to welcome back to our microphone Star Trek expert, my partner, on Enterprise Incidents with Scott and Steve, and one of the greatest guests in the annals of the Cinephiles, Scott Mance. Welcome back to the show.
That is high praise indeed, my friend. Thank you so much for having me back. And what a treat that I get to do not just one, not just two, but three parts on Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home with my friends, Johnny Rocha and Steve Morris. Great to be back. And where did we leave off?
Well, before we get there, we should mention that we cannot make The Cinephiles without our great supporters on Patreon, as well as Apple Podcasts. Thank you so much. Literally, you are what keeps our microphones running.
Yeah, thank you so much. And the other way that you can support the show, because a lot of you talk about how you want to support us here on The Cinephiles. Some of you can't do it financially. So another way you could do that is if you hear products and from people that sponsor us here on the show, the clients that sponsor us here on the show, if those products work for your daily life so you can fit it into your budget, you can use our code to get a huge discount on those products. And that lets those sponsors know that that you're an audience that likes to use their stuff, and they'll keep coming back to sponsor us every month. So thanks to everybody who's been taking advantage of that, especially the True Diagnostic people. They have gotten back to us that they are so incredibly happy with how many of you all have reached out to them. So if you have been hesitating on it, highly recommend you do it. Reach out to True Diagnostic as one of our sponsors, because they're very happy with how the response has gone.
And by the way, if we're just throwing out some stuff here, if you've been listening to not just one, not just two, but now three parts of Star Trek IV, then you should absolutely be listening to Enterprise Incidents with Scott and Steve, which is our deep dive podcast into each and every episode of the original Star Trek series, still the very greatest Star Trek series of them all, which is just 1 year shy of its 60th anniversary. Now is the perfect time to start from the beginning and go through episode by episode in production order with a completely fresh take on the overreaching arc of the Kirk-Spock-McCoy relationship of the original Star Trek series, Enterprise Incidents with Scott and Steve. If you're not listening, you're missing out on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, and now I can finally answer your question, Scott, which is where we left off. Jillian had run into the Bounty, and they had finally just, she was making a lot of noise, so they finally just beamed her up onto the ship. Kirk said, "Alice, welcome to Wonderland," and she gets to have that moment of realizing that these crazy two guys that she met at the aquarium are actually from the future.
You know what's interesting is how, you know, for people who've been watching, so when this came out in 1986, it was the 20th anniversary, only the 20th anniversary of Star Trek. But it was also, this was the only Star Trek you had. You had the movies, you had the original series. Mm. You know, Next Generation was still about a year away. But what's interesting is how Jillian is kind of all of us. Just like the way that Captain Christopher represented everybody watching Star Trek in 1966 or 1967, rather, that's when the episode aired. Then for every Star Trek fan who'd been loving Star Trek for all these years, Gillian was now their entry point into, well, I mean, they are in the 20th century, but this is still a Star Trek movie and these characters from the 23rd century. So she represents all of us.
They were taken last night. I wasn't told. They're in Alaska by now.
Damn.
I mean, this is a huge reversal. And Gillian's just like...
But they're tagged, like I told you. I mean, you can go find them, right?
Can't go anywhere.
What kind of a spaceship is this?
It's a spaceship with a missing man.
And again, the stakes are raised because the time is running out. The whales are out at sea. We got to get the whales before we, you know, God forbid, they get hunted down by whale hunters. But they also have to save Chekhov, who, you know, he's in a hospital in the 20th century. That can't be good. I mean, he's also the fact that he's in the hospital isn't good anyway. But this is just something that Star Trek has done so well over the course of certainly the three seasons and some of the movies here. It's just... the stakes keep getting raised. There's more jeopardy with each passing scene. It gets stacked on top of itself, and it just increases the stakes for our heroes to get it all done.
It's funny. The Enterprise clearly has a system of never leave a man behind.
Yeah.
Unless, of course, he's got a red shirt on, in which case it's a totally different thing. But the last person, the reason I bring it up is the last person we didn't leave behind is the next person who speaks.
Admiral, full power has been restored.
And Gillian gets to look over and finally see Spock without that headband.
Yeah. Without the headband, she sees the eyes and the ears and welcome aboard. And she just kind of like nods her head like, thanks.
Again, the nonverbal acting, you've got to watch that in this film. She does a great job with it. The fact that she lingers on staring at him and goes through the thought process of like, oh, who is the, oh, that's him. Oh, really? So it's all right in her face. And so that's the mark of great actors, when you see that they're processing the things and they're not just blowing right past them. You know, she does a great job with that.
Yep.
Well, and you know, Scott, to your point from our last episode, Gillian, not unlike Edith Keeler, she's already anticipating things about the future. And so she isn't as surprised as you think that she would be with all of this.
Absolutely. You'd think she'd be like freaking out, but she's – look, she just wasn't made for these times, the 20th century. There's something about her that is, she's not in her element. She soon will be, but just like Edith Keeler was way ahead of her time, so is Gillian. There's a lot to both of these characters that make them similar that I just never really gave it a thought until just sort of approaching this episode of Cinephiles, doing Star Trek IV with you, making me see Star Trek IV in a completely new way after all these years. And it makes sense.
And at this moment is when Uhura chimes in and says they found Chekhov. He's in the hospital. He's in critical condition and not expected to survive.
Jim, you've got to let me go in there. Don't leave him in the hands of 20th century medicine.
Admiral, may I suggest that Dr. McCoy is correct? We must help Chekhov.
Is that the logical thing to do, Spock?
No, but it is the human thing to do.
And that goes back to your point, Steve, that you made earlier about how ever since... Oh, no, wait, John, I think this was your point about how having McCoy, you know, them share, of all people, Spock and McCoy having to share, you know, a body, you know, with the Katra, that Spock is a change. He's that more than anything is... not even the death experience and the resurrection, but more of him sharing space with the most emotional human he could possibly know. Right. That is really what's changed him more than anything.
Can I tell you the epiphany I had literally an hour ago?
Tell us.
Sure.
So we've been talking about Spock. It's just an evolution of all the things we've been talking about how his character grows and changes through the course of the series. And the thought that I had about an hour ago is when we're young, particularly this is true of young men, but this is true of everybody, you really want to know who you're supposed to be. And young men frequently get fascinated by codes, samurai codes of honor. What is a man supposed to be? I'm supposed to be like this. This is what a man does. This is what a person does. And we're also desperate for affection and approval from the community that we're in. And so we're trying to fit in and we're trying to do all things, trying to be something. And then there's this thing that happens, and it certainly happened to me, and my guess is it's happened to both of you, somewhere in your late 40s, early 50s, where you start to go, fuck that. Why am I doing this? And the real question becomes, who am I? Who do I want to be? It stops being so important to fulfill all these codes and please all these other people. And I was like, oh, that's where Spock is. When he was young, he was like, I'm trying to be full Vulcan. That's the goal. And anything else stressed him out. I mean, he literally torn to pieces in a lot of ways by these struggling parts of his personality. Mm-hmm. And now he's going, yeah, I'm Vulcan and I'm human. And that's all great. I'm going to be me. I'm just going to be me. That's who I'm going to be. And I'll tell you one more thing is I had to look up exactly how old Leonard Nimoy was when he made this movie. And he was 55 years old. Oh, basically exactly my age, maybe going through those same moments of like, oh, I don't have to conform to some ideal. I can just be me.
You know, it's funny you say that. First of all, I did not realize that Leonard Nimoy was 55 when he directed Star Trek IV. I'm 56 now. And that,
I'm still 35.
You know, we've all been through, you know, various stages of our lives where we, you know, maybe want to pivot, hit the reset button, you know, we take stock of ourselves. You know, I mean, you know, full disclosure, I'm certainly going through that now. You know, we work in a business where there is a shelf life on things. And I am, you know, asking myself that very same question, like, who am I? What am I doing? This is really what I want to do. Probably more information that you would expect on an episode of The Cinephiles, but truth. Really. I'm not even joking. I've really been trying to take stock of like, okay, you know, I did this for this part of my life. I did that for that part of my life. Now that I'm in this part of my life, what do I want to do with it? That is absolutely, people go through stages for sure. And, you know, some people just do one job for the rest of their lives. I think in entertainment show business, you don't do that. Even actors do different things every time they act. Yeah. Like it's just a very, very challenging time for anybody working in the entertainment industry because of all the challenges that people in production and you know, criticism, press, everybody is facing. Anyway, not to digress.
Well, fortunately, in the 23rd century, they're going to have all sorts of cures for all these problems because they will have figured it all out, because that's what happens next, which is, and I think this next sequence is just pure silly fun, which is we show up at the hospital and immediately we're just charging through. Jillian's with them. We're dressed as doctors. And immediately we see this woman on a gurney.
What's the matter with you?
Kidney dialysis.
Dialysis? God, what is this, the Dark Ages?
He gives her a pill and walks away.
So great. Set up, and then the payoff is even better.
And I think this is a minor but key detail, which is that immediately they come up with the plan, and Jillian immediately jumps on that gurney and understands the scam that they're going to run.
Yeah, yeah. She's up for it. You know, and everything we've seen before this moment, you know that she is a woman who is ruled by her beliefs and her passions. And so this is a situation where she is going to get involved. She is jumping in with both feet. So she's a very committed person. When she believes in something, she goes full bore into it. And so the fact that she's jumping into the gurney, ready to be part of this game, and then going to be moaning her eyes out in a few seconds, shows you that she is she cares about these whales, and she'll do whatever she can to save them, you know.
In the elevator with a bunch of doctors talking about chemotherapy, it's basically same joke, different way.
Unbelievable. Do you have a different view, doctor?
Sounds like the goddamn Spanish Inquisition to me.
So I want to tell you a quick story. The blonde gentleman in the elevator is a man I worked with for a year at a TV station. His name is Tom Mustin. He was a burgeoning actor at the time, very young. In his career, because I had this conversation with him after I met him in the 90s, and he worked at the Charlottesville NBC station. And that's where I got to know him when I was taking a break between community college and going to Florida State. Really awesome gentleman. He stayed in the business, in the news. He's out of Colorado now, but really nice guy. And so when I asked him, but he said it was just a joy to be on the set for shooting that scene. And being in an elevator with one of my heroes from Star Trek days and William Shatner was an amazing experience. And so
was he nice? Was he
nice? Yeah, he said he was nice to him. No negative stuff. And he said, but he said like this was an it didn't work out for him as an actor, but this was something he did in that at that time because he was trying to kind of break into the business. But it always makes me smile because you can only see this scene with him in it after they had released the 16:9 version. In the TV original 4:3, he was always cut off at the side. It was just one of those things that you discover later on. You know,
that's so cool. That's really cool.
Very cool.
By the way, my feeling about Shatner, having heard all the stories, I know, Scott, you've met him many times, but to me, it just sounds like it's not even a question of nice or not nice. It's just Shatner's going to Shatner.
Right.
He's just gonna Shatner. And it's gonna be what it's gonna be, you know.
True.
We get to the corridor where Chekhov is being held, and of course there's cops there who don't want to let them in because this is a secure area, and Bones says,
"Damn it, do you want an acute case on your hands? This woman has immediate postprandial upper abdominal distension."
And they immediately get out of the way. This is a great joke. They say, "What do you say she's got?"
Cramps.
It's just all so much fun, you know.
Like, this is a really, really fun scene. This is such a fun scene.
It's not master filmmaking. It's not deep character. It's just here are characters we love, and we get to love watching them do this thing. Because now they're going to drill a hole in Chekhov's head, and Bones is arguing with them, and finally,
"My God, man, drilling holes in his head's not the answer. The artery must be repaired. Now put away your butcher knives and let me save this patient before it's too late."
And when they start to argue, that's when Kirk pulls the phaser, puts the doctor in another room, and melts the door handle so they can't get out.
Okay, I just like that, you know, Kirk, he just, you know, is really cool about it. And then he finally, like, he just takes out the phaser and says, "Get in there."
And then, you know, McCoy puts his little device on Chekhov's head. By the way, Scott, we made a joke throughout all of Enterprise incidents that McCoy is the worst doctor in the world when it comes to first aid. All he does, he sees this person on the ground, and he just goes, "He's dead, Jim." He doesn't just no CPR. He doesn't put any drugs in him. Like, there's more first aid in any episode of ER than McCoy ever does. But in Star Trek IV, he can cure everybody.
He made up. You know what? He made up for all of his shortcomings as a doctor on the Enterprise. Like, he's in the 20th century. He's like, you know, rubbing his hands together, you know, like going to cure the lady of dialysis and definitely making up for his shortcomings.
It reminds me of a professional basketball player who is all the way at the end of the bench. Like, he's bad compared to the other players that are in his league. But when he comes down to the local rec league, he destroys everybody.
Exactly.
And Bones is essentially bringing 23rd century knowledge to the 20th century. So he can kick ass here.
And Chekhov's eyes start to flutter open.
"Name, rank."
"Chekhov. Pavel. Rank. Admiral."
Admiral.
But they're not out of the woods yet. They got to get out of the hospital.
I want to focus on this joke just for a moment.
Okay.
So first of all, one of the interesting things, and it really was clear to me, Scott, when we did our show, we did our watch along, is how Chekhov fits into the crew when he shows up on the Enterprise, which is for some reason, Chekhov, the youngest, lowest ranked person in the group, feels perfectly comfortable making jokes. You know, that are kind of pushing the boundaries of things and being a little, all the Russian jokes, all that stuff. He just, and so my question for this moment, is he actually not fully conscious and fantasizing that he's an admiral, or is Chekhov making a joke?
I think he's making a joke.
Yeah,
I think he's making a joke.
I mean, if you like, you know, like the way that Kirk was just like, you know, name, rank, you know, he says his name, you know, and then he says his rank, you know, it's like, "Admiral." Like, totally a joke.
It's the smile that he said "Admiral" with that shows you that he's joking. Yeah.
Yeah. It's the pause and then the smile and that slow "Admiral."
"How's the patient, doctor?"
"He's going to make it."
"He, you came in with a sheet."
"One little mistake."
And then the worst cops possibly in the history of film. You literally could just grab the gurney. But instead, they let the bad guys go with the patient they were supposed to be guarding and run into the surgery room. It's crazy. And then we have a fun run out where, of course, again, we run into the old lady who is ecstatically dancing about her new kidney that apparently grew entirely back.
Yeah, just like that. I got a new kidney. I got a new kidney.
And they're running through the hospital. They go into the elevator, call for Scotty to transport them. And, of course, the doors open and the cops see an empty room. And they beam into the park before walking up the steps into the Bounty. And I'm going like, why did Scotty not beam them just straight to the transporter room on the Bounty? And the only reason I can think of that they would do, it's got to be a scheduling reason. That's the only thing.
Why? Because you can't take Jillian onto the ship. Like,
You're right, John.
You're right, John.
Very good. Thank you.
Because he's, you know, Scotty's been around a while. So he knows, like, we can't be taking no 20 the surgery person back with us.
Jillian was already on the ship.
She had they're about to leave.
You're totally right. But what it really is it's not like the Scotty knowing that he shouldn't beam Jillian aboard is I think motivatable. And I think that's what we're going to decide is happening. But what's really happening is that the screenwriters are going, we want this last scene and it has to be in the park.
Right.
Therefore, we have to beam them to the park. Otherwise, we can't have this scene the way it is.
Fair. Yeah, totally. Yeah. Hey, Cinefalls fans, this is John and back with Steve here to talk about True Diagnostic. Now, Steve, you took this test a month ago and it recommended some stuff for you to do. So where are you at in the process working with True Diagnostic?
Well, the cool thing about the test is that it gives you your biological age. How are you aging as compared to your actual age? My actual age is 56. And for the most part, I'm spot on aging at the same speed as my age. I'd rather age a little more slowly, but that's where we are. But the one area that concerned me was the biological age of my brain is both older and aging faster than the rest of me. My brain, according to this test, is 60 years old and aging faster. And that's a real cause for concern. Fortunately, True Diagnostic has recommendations.
Yeah, so what did they recommend? What are they saying for you to do in order to deal with this?
The nice thing is it gives specific recommendations based on my test results for choices I can make going forward, both in terms of diet, exercise, as well as supplements. And I'm trying to implement them. And in a couple of months, I do another test and we see how my aging has changed.
Oh man, I'm looking forward to that. I want to hear those results for sure. Well, if you care about protecting your health and want to find out what your real age is, head over to truediagnostic.com and use our code Cinephiles to get 20% off your entire order or subscription. That's truediagnostic.com and use Cinefiles at checkout to get 20% off. Your future self will thank you. Steve, you know, I've been losing weight and I've been, kind of looking at food I can make for myself that's going to keep me on this path and keep me healthy. But making food that is fast, flavorful, and still feels special isn't easy. So I turned to my friend, who is a foodie and I would say a burgeoning chef in Steve Morris. Steve, how can you help me with this, man?
Well, thank you. I take that as quite an honor that I can be your chef de cuisine right now. I mean, the first thing for me is always getting great ingredients, which might mean a trip to the farmer's market, but not everything is in season all the time. And that's why I turn to red raspberries from Washington. These berries are grown purposely to be frozen, which means they can be frozen at the peak of freshness by passionate farmers in Washington State. And that's why we know that the quality will absolutely be top-notch when you put them into a recipe. One that I like to do is sometimes when I'm making a steak, I worry that the heaviness of the meat might be too much. So maybe a little bit of acid would help. So I've made a beautiful balsamic and raspberry reduction to drizzle over that perfect ribeye steak. And then for the end of the meal, now I know John's on a diet, but for those of you who aren't, you add a little bit of sugar and some lemon juice to macerate those raspberries, drizzle them over a little vanilla ice cream, maybe some chocolate syrup, some whipped cream. I guarantee it's going to be one of the best ice cream sundaes you've ever had.
That's great, Steve. Well, if you all want to discover new ways to use American frozen red raspberries and get more details on where you can grab a bag of these delicious berries, go to redraz.org. That's redraz.org. You'll find recipes, health tips, retail locations, and everything you need to make frozen Washington red raspberries a regular part of your routine. And remember, look for Product of the U.S. on the bag.
Now, Kirk just wants to get that radio frequency so he can track them.
What are you talking about? I'm coming with you.
You can't. Our next stop is the 23rd century.
Well, I don't care. I've got nobody here. I have got to help.
I haven't got time to argue with you.
And Kirk is just like, no, you know, which I understand. That you can't just kidnap her and take her to another century, and she might die in the process anyway.
Right. That's right.
She gives him the frequency. He thanks her. And then he says, I think, is this as close to beam me up, Scotty, as we ever get in Star Trek?
Correct. Yeah. Correct. Great. Scotty comes first, but instead of beam me up, Scotty is Scotty. Beam me up. And then just as soon as he said that, she jumps in his arms. The beam starts and she says,
surprise.
And it's, again, it's almost romantic. It's right. But it isn't. It's, or it's like right on the edge of, is this romantic?
It feels like there is some... There is definitely something is there. There is a spark between them. They're of great chemistry. She jumps into his arms. Doesn't step into the beam. She jumps into his arms, surprise, and she is like kind of flustered a little bit being that close to him. And this moment when they beam back into the Bounty, this is like the end of Act Two of this movie.
Back on the bridge.
So I'm trying to remember how this thing worked. Got used to a Huey.
For the entire second act, basically, you saw the crew of the Enterprise, absolute fish out of water for our benefit, for the comic relief of it all. And Jillian is like our window into this world of dealing with these people who are out of their element. But now the Bounty has taken off and they are all at their stations, they are back in their element. I mean, they're not physically back in the 23rd century, but in their heads, they are, because they are back at their stations and they're speaking their language. So as much, it's just such a great transition from the way that Kirk and McCoy and Scotty and Sulu, and they're all, Chekhov and Uhura especially, they're out of their element and now they are back in it and they are doing the jobs that they've been doing for many, many, many years that they are great at, and they're doing the jobs that we have seen them do. They're back in character. The fish are back in the water, so to speak.
One of the things that's nice, I think, about having the Klingon Bird of Prey rather than the Enterprise, no disrespect to the Enterprise, the greatest starships ever, but is that part of it is special effects and part of it is the conceit of how the Federation works, is that we don't have a lot of fast-flying ships, you know?
Yeah,
Scott has just brought up his beautiful model of the USS Enterprise, and so it's just fun to have the Klingon Bird of Prey flying over San Francisco, and because you get this sense of speed and excitement, it's just fun.
You present the appearance of a man with a problem.
Your perception is correct, Doctor. In order to return us to the exact moment we left the 23rd century, I have used our journey back through time as a referent, calculating the coefficient of elapsed time in relation to the acceleration curve.
Naturally. So what's your problem?
Acceleration is no longer a constant.
Well, then you're just going to have to take your best shot.
Best shot?
Guess, Spock. Your best guess.
Guessing is not in my nature, Doctor.
Well, nobody's perfect.
So many great moments that McCoy and Spock have had, many of them contentious, but some of them... some of them really intimate, and this is the intimate one, that McCoy is not losing his patience with Spock. He's trying to reach him on a human level, one that Spock is more open to than he probably has been in a very long time, if not ever.
Agree or disagree with the following statement. Spock and McCoy are the greatest love-hate friendship in all of cinema and TV.
Agree 100%.
I would need time. I would need time with that one.
I would too. I mean, I had to think about it too, but they're up there.
It's up there.
Yeah.
I mean, Abbott or Costello.
Yeah. We have contact with the whales. We're heading towards them. And what do we see as we head towards the whales but a whaling boat? And to me, this is like the setup for one of the strangest action builds in cinema history. It's totally unlike anything else, you know?
Yeah. It is unlike anything else. And the original idea for this moment was also unlike anything else, except maybe the movie Black Sunday, because Hart Bennett and Nicholas Meyer cut apart in the film from the original script where the Bird of Prey was supposed to appear over the Super Bowl halftime show.
Oh, wow.
I'm not sure why they would have been there, or if it would have been earlier in the film. Maybe they would have arrived, you know, in San Francisco during the Super Bowl. Who knows? But there was definitely a moment when the Bird of Prey was supposed to peer over the Super Bowl halftime show, and all the people watching the halftime show thought it was like, you know, some spectacle, and they were all cheering it on.
I can't even get my head around how that how we would make that fit into any of this story.
I think they took it out.
So we're flying in, and it's basically we see the whale swimming underwater. We see the whaling ship and that it's spotted them and that it's heading towards them. We see them loading the harpoon. We're getting closer and closer. And there is, I feel like, for me emotionally, a real sense of dread for the whales who don't know how much danger they're in at that moment, you know?
The scene always, even as many times as I've seen the movie, I always get like, oh no. Yeah. Even though I know they're going to be okay, I still get really worried about the whales because, you know, they're totally innocent creatures, you know, and they're being hunted. And now we're seeing a hunt in motion. And even though, you know, they're going to be okay, I still always get worried when I see this, this moment.
Do you think they used foreign people, foreign to America people? Because they didn't want it to be Americans who were taking out these whales. Like, do you think that was a conscious choice? I mean, we're in Alaska, right?
Yeah, somewhere near Alaska. I mean, Americans aren't, as far as I know, aren't whaling. We're not doing, I mean, there might be some rogue American dude who's participating in whaling. But mostly it's Japan and a few other countries. Right. Very few countries actually were whaling during the 80s.
Good point.
So that makes sense to me. And we're getting closer and closer, and they've got their harpoon is aimed. They got the whales dead to right. The harpoon fires. It's shooting out towards the whales, and then it runs into something metal, which I find so satisfying in this moment.
Yeah. And I love the big reveal, reveal when the Bird of Prey decloaks and the front of the Bird of Prey with the photon torpedo, like red, like it's going to fire. It's not going to. But just the most ominous angle of the Bird of Prey above the whaling boat, just to scare the hell out of them, and that's exactly what it does. It scares the hell out of them. They're turning the wheel like in going around in circles. They have no idea. There's the 23rd century right in front of their eyes.
Yeah,
it's a fantastic moment, and it just kind of brings home. You know, one of the struggles today is trying to find who is it okay to have as your bad guy. Because everything has been politicized. So, you know, based on the country of origin or the race, or is it a corporate bad guy or is it a government bad guy? And like everything people will jump on a side on in our world today, the whales are a great solution. Even though it's environmental in nature, which is a more lefty thing, we all love George and Gracie. Nobody wants to see George and Gracie get killed. And so we're just like, great. Scare the crap out of the whalers with the giant, you know, with the Klingon ship. This is awesome. We love it.
Yeah.
Now we're back on the Bounty, and Scotty has to beam up two humpback whales in all their water, and he is very nervous, and there they appear behind the glass, and Scotty says,
Admiral, there be whales here.
But this is more than just a beam in, like we've seen a million times between the 80 episodes and previous three films. Like, The beam in for the whales, because it's not just the whales, laddie, it's the water, it's a slow beam in. And as it's slowly beaming in, you can hear the infrastructure of the Bird of Prey being maxed out because of all the pressure of the whales and the water. And, you know, you can understand why Scotty is nervous. He's like, boy, I hope that this transparent aluminum holds the whales and holds the water. And then it does. And he says his line. And it's one of the great Scotty moments. Yeah. Admiral, there be whales here. It was Jimmy's favorite line, James Doohan's favorite line in all of Star Trek that he did.
Wow. Oh, wow. Oh,
yep.
That's cool. That's very cool.
Well, Mr. Spock, have you accounted for the variable mass of whales and water in your time reentry program?
Mr. Scott cannot give me exact figures, Admiral, so I will make a guess.
A guess? You, Spock? That's extraordinary.
So, first of all, I just love the moment. I love that Spock has embraced the guess thing, and I love the penetrating nature of Kirk to realize how big a deal that is, that he's doing that.
Yeah. Although he gets a little bit Anchorman-ish sometimes, don't you think?
We are laughing.
He's like pointing out the things that are happening. It's like, you know what? Let me get to it on my own time. How about that? How about you not put so much pressure on? But you know that's who Kirk is, and it's all from a place of love for his friend to pull him back to where he was before. So, yeah.
And this might, speaking of the love-hate relationship, this might be among the sweetest moments for me from McCoy ever.
I don't think he understands.
No, Spock. He means that he feels safer about your guesses than most other people's facts.
Then you're saying it is a compliment.
It is.
Ah. Then I will try to make the best guess I can.
It's just McCoy reassuring him.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, what a relationship to see the ups and downs of the Spock-McCoy relationship. You know, from I think its peak of contention being in All Our Yesterdays when Spock goes to strangle him and McCoy says, are you trying to kill me, Spock? Like, and that came after three seasons of arguments. And then, you know, in Star Trek III, you're suffering from the effects of a Vulcan mind melt. That green-blooded son of a bitch. It's his revenge for all those arguments he lost. I mean, there's so many great moments between these guys. But you're right, Steve. This is really, really, really nice.
Jillian is looking at the whales, and Kirk, who I am sure Shatner insisted that he get this line. You know what I mean? He says,
they say the sea is cold, but the sea contains the hottest blood of all.
Whales weep not. D.H. Lawrence.
So the rest of that quote, and the wildest, the most urgent. So, Steve Morris.
Yes.
How did James T. Kirk know about this quote?
I'm assuming you're asking so that I will reply, because he's a nerd and he had a stack of books. He was a stack of books with legs.
Correct. He is a nerd. We keep coming back to that because it's true. He's a nerd.
We also keep coming back to the quote
before she did.
We also keep coming back to it because we're nerds and it makes us feel good that Kirk is one of us.
It's true. That we're in the same boat as Captain Kirk.
I love the little moment when Scotty says,
the beasties seem happy to see you, Doctor. I hope you like our little aquarium.
A miracle, Mr. Scott.
Now, she doesn't know that he's known as the miracle worker, but he is, you know.
Yes, he is.
A miracle? That's yet to come.
And that's when he explains, hey, by coming with us, you're probably going to die. Because we're trying to go through time with a bunch of whales in an old ship. This might not work very well.
But that's the thing. That's the thing, isn't it, guys? Like they just did this incredible accomplishment of tracking down the whales, of installing the right infrastructure inside the bird of prey to hold the whales. And the water, they beam up the whales and the water, and the whales are fine. They're fine. They're alive and well.
Right.
But damn, we got to get this thing back to the 23rd century. Yeah. So, you know, we are so not out of the woods yet.
Admiral, I need thruster control. Acceleration thrust is at Spock's command.
We're going faster and faster towards the sun, and fortunately, we do not go into any weird dissolving through different shapes of the crew member time travel.
What I love about the scene is, you're right, we skipped over the whole weird bit that we had to see when we went back into the 20th century. But we are breaking thrusters have fired. And Kirk says, when the hell are we? And then, you know, you don't see the exterior. There's nothing on the view screen. He doesn't say, screen, you know, give me a visual. We hear the probe and the power starts to dim. And it's just this ominous, ominous feeling. And Kirk just says, the probe. Like, we're back.
It's one of those cases where not showing this, a bunch of them in this episode, where not showing the special effects, not going to the spectacle is more dramatic than it would have been if we had seen the probe.
It is a dramatic moment. Absolutely. Yeah.
And I love at this moment that we cut back to Starfleet at the moment before the ship left, when that very iconic visual happened of the glass breaking.
Get him back! Get him back!
I love going right back to that moment.
Yeah, they arrived back as from the at the moment they left. And the moment they left, you see Sarek like looking, but now he says, look! And he's obviously pointing to the bird of prey falling, spiraling out of control from the sky.
Flies down through this terrible storm, past the Golden Gate Bridge, crashes into the water, and things go really, really fast right now.
We're in the water! Blow the hatch! Right place, Spock. All we have to do is get the whales out of here before we sink. Abandon ship.
Yeah, I mean, this is the Titanic at this point. We're abandoning ship. People are climbing out. Kirk is heading down to save to get to the whales. Scotty and Jillian are trapped near the whales.
Whales are trapped. They'll drown.
There's no power to the bay door. You go on ahead. And close the hatch.
Admiral, you'll be trapped.
Go on.
Because this is what Kirk does.
This is what Kirk does. This is a great Kirk moment that, you know, where you would see him, you know, fight Khan in the engineering room at the end of Spacey, you know, where he would save the day. This is a true classic Star Trek original series moment.
Yeah. And it's really cool. And by the way, it sounds like, it looks really scary, him swimming through this debris with all this stuff in the hold. And according to Shatner, it sounds like it was pretty scary, you know, like because you're swimming. I don't have, like, swimming, I'm a very strong swimmer, but swimming under things freaks me out.
Yeah.
And so having to do this kind of a thing would be very scary.
Especially at his age when he was making the movie, you know?
And I have a question. I the only person who in underwater sequences like this always holds my breath to see if I can hold my breath as long as the movie?
I think instinctively... I feel like I'm underwater too. You know what I mean? I don't know if I hold my breath.
Yeah, I never do that.
Always do it. There was
you're always challenging yourself. You're always challenging yourself.
Listen, there was I grew up in a very competitive household, and there was a lot. My mom's still in the house that I grew up with. There's a pool there, and there was a lot of how long you can hold your breath, how many laps can you swim underwater. Like all that was a big deal in my household. The answer is my record was 6 laps underwater without a breath.
Wow, very impressive.
I spent a lot of time underwater trying to hold my breath as a kid. This is the weird things we do. But so he swims through. I like the design of that manual override that he has to open up and then pull down. And he finally does it. He opens up the door. I love the bubbles as the seal opens and he swims out up to the surface and is pulled out into the stormy weather by Mr. Spock.
Every time I go to Paramount Studios in Hollywood, 5555 Melrose Avenue, every single time I go there for like a screening or a meeting or whatever, every time I look over at the water tower, I look at the big blue screen that they have there. You know, they've filmed many movies in that parking lot that they use as a water tank. Another film that was filmed there was Patriot Games, you know, the end of the film with Harrison Ford. But this is where they filmed on the Paramount lot, right maybe steps away from where the original series was filmed at Stage 31 or Desilu Stage 9. And that's where they filmed this scene of them clinging to the front of the bird of prey, hoping that the whales will start singing.
Why don't they answer? Why don't they sing?
And we see the whales descend, and then they slowly rotate till their heads are pointed down. And then we go back to the probe that's in space, and it's no longer making that ominous noise. And then it moves, turning in space, also pointing its essentially head down to match the whales. And it's all very quiet throughout this moment, so that when the whale song comes, it's really, really powerful.
So, you know, every time I've seen this movie, and everything, they show the close up of either George or Gracie, one of the whales, and you see the eye. I thought that was a real whale. I had no idea that was an animatronic whale. But what I will also say is, after seeing this movie a few times back in the day during the 80s, every single time after that I would watch Jaws, and there's that scene on the orca right before the shark attacks, you know, for the big finale scene, when they're sitting below deck and he's talking about the Indianapolis and you hear the whale song, I think of Star Trek IV.
Of course. That makes sense. That makes sense. And then we have, and I think you mentioned, Scott, before, that this was supposed to be subtitled, essentially a conversation between the whales and the probe, but fortunately, we're not subtitled.
Yeah,
I think this is very Close Encounters-ish. I hadn't thought about it until this last time watching, but we have this musical, essentially, conversation going on that we can't understand, you know?
Yeah, you know, I think the conversation is actually, hey, I'm going to Starbucks. You want anything? Hey, can you get me a mocha? Do you want a frappuccino? No, just a regular hot mocha. You want a grande, a venti? Yeah, make it a grande.
Oh, and maybe wipe out all these humans, because I don't care that they brought us to the future. They literally killed all the other ones of us on this planet.
Right.
Well, I have to say, I've never thought of Close Encounters. So that's interesting. I haven't seen it. I always think of 2001. It just, I have to.
Sure.
Right, because the monolith there, essentially in the sky, the black thing that it is, reminds me. And then even the probe, when they do the close-up of the probe, which looks like, I don't know what, like almost like a baby. It almost looks like a space baby, a whale baby in the way it's designed. So for me, that's what I look. And the glowing off the probe, it just makes it feel that way to me. But Close Encounters, certainly, Steve, that makes sense with the way they're communicating, considering how that was.
Yeah, you don't know. That's not subtitled either.
Right,
I mean, it's really that's a really great comparison.
And then that ball goes back up into the probe, and we don't know what that means, except we means that something's happened, something's changed. We've won, and it goes horizontal and disappears, and then the music becomes more positive, and the whales come up to the surface, and they're splashing, and the crew is cheering, and the clouds are clear, and
the
power comes back on, and then the fun music hits and the whales are just jumping and playing and the crew is playing and joyful. And I feel like almost to me, and I'm curious what you guys think. Mm. This scene to me is the culmination of all of Star Trek, the original series. This is like, it's not discarding 5 and 6 or anything like that, but this is the moment, the greatest moment of the crew of the Enterprise, the most joyful coming together moment in the history of Star Trek. You know,
that's accurate. Mm. And you know, there's the joy that comes from this, you know, the way that, Kirk pulls Spock into the water. Just such a gleeful embrace of each other that they pulled this off. They did it. All the steps they had to go through, you know, what's that line that Tom Hanks says in Apollo 13, you know, he goes, we have to do 100 things and we're on step 3. I mean, they had to do a lot. And yeah, the weather is great. There's no fog in, you know, coming in off the, you know, Golden Gate Bridge. And they're, the music really adds to the joy. It's such a joyous moment for sure.
Yeah. I mean, and I don't know, because I can't remember what the feeling was that, you know, we know that George Takei had issues with Shatner. We know that some of the actors in the series were getting tired of being typecast and seen as only this. And so I don't know if maybe they sensed this was their like final goodbye to the series and didn't maybe necessarily have plans for a 5 or 6 and weren't sure if this was going to be uber successful or not. And so maybe this is their way of saying, well, if this is the last one we do, we're going to go out with that feeling of brotherhood and friendship and love for each other and joy, and even breaking the fourth wall a little bit with how much we are enjoying being almost childlike in this moment, splashing around the water. Because nothing can bring you back to that feeling, because it's so universal, of splashing around in a swimming pool with your friends.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And so to me, it makes it feel like that kind of childish energy to it that puts the walls down on these adult characters and makes them really accessible and vulnerable in these moments, in this moment.
Two more things about this. The first is, and I have such a strong memory of this in the theater, is when Spock smiles, it's just a joy. Like there's this thing. It's like this thing we've been waiting, and we've seen Spock smile a few times before, but it was always fraught with all this thing. And here it's not. And it's just like, oh, Spock's just happy, and he's okay being happy.
Right.
He's not trying to pretend he's not happy. He's just happy. And it's just such a powerful moment. The other thing, for all the people out there who are desperate to recreate this moment and their next visit to San Francisco, be warned, the San Francisco Bay is very cold. This is not fun to swim in.
Sure. Council is now in session. Bring in the accused.
And the crew enters and Spock walks up to them.
Captain Spock, you do not stand accused.
Mr. President, I stand with my shipmates.
This is the first time, by the way, when they show up for the trial, that we see Kirk and Spock and McCoy and Scotty and Sulu, Uhura and Chekov wearing those Starfleet uniforms since Star Trek II.
Wow. Oh, yeah.
Or no, sorry, the beginning of Star Trek III. The beginning of Star Trek III.
Admiral Kirk, how do you plead?
On behalf of all of us, Mr. President, I'm authorized to plead guilty.
So entered. Because of certain mitigating circumstances, all charges but one are summarily dismissed.
Yay!
Yay! They better be dismissed after all that.
This is an outrage.
I love the way they kind of squared this circle. I think this is a brilliant choice, the next thing they do. Because all the way back to Star Trek, the motion picture, we know Kirk wanted to get back to being the captain of a ship. Like, we knew that, and that's what the whole plot of Two is. We've talked about this.
James T. Kirk, it is the judgment of this council that you be reduced in rank to captain. And that as a consequence of your new rank, you be given the duties for which you have repeatedly demonstrated unswerving ability. The command of a starship.
I love it. You know, the only bummer is that we didn't just get a new Star Trek TOS series and we could just have dozens of adventures rather than just a couple.
Yeah.
But this is a fascinating thing. Cause I mean, when I was younger, of course, I would see this moment and this just kind of underscored the beautiful moment we just saw with them out in the water and, you know, how sweet that is. And so, of course, they're going to... But, like, if I was a Klingon, if I was another species, and the fact that Kirk got away with this and did all the things... Yes, you saved the planet of Earth, but, like, you still did stuff to the Klingon people. I'm still upset. And it's an interesting thing that they, like, kind of avoided that. And then all these people are celebrating. Of course, it's the Federation, but... You know, we've seen in subsequent series how much the Federation wasn't as unified as we were led to believe in the 80s and the 60s and in this version of Star Trek. And so it would have been interesting to see a shot of like the Klingon ambassador storming out or something, or maybe a Romulan ambassador storming out. But they got away with everything. And they end up getting what they wanted, as you said, Steve, from the beginning, which is what Spock says to Kirk in Two, right? You're what, first and best... place or
commanding
position.
A starship is your first best destiny.
Yes, that's it. First best destiny. Thank you, Scott. But yeah, I mean, he gets away with it. They all get away with it. And so I imagine it would have been interesting to see the Klingon point of view of this. Of like, of course they get away with it. They're favorites, for God's sakes. What is the going to take? You know. So it's a fascinating moment. But yes, it's a beautiful moment. I agree with you, Steve. It's just that the way they started this movie, there was issues with what was going on. You know.
Right.
I'm so glad you brought this up. And you had also brought up your idea of doing a Klingon-focused,
yes,
what is their perspective through all these events. And you're totally right, because if we had them storming out, it perfectly sets up Star Trek VI.
Yes.
Like, then we get, you know, it's like, that's what this... And I'm so glad you brought this up, too, because, frankly, this is what governments do. Governments don't just do what is right.
Yeah.
They do what is expedient at that moment based on a whole bunch of stuff.
Right. If they had failed at this, or I don't know, because they'd all be dead, I guess, if they had failed at this. But I mean, if they hadn't really gotten the mission correct, I think the president would have delivered a different judgment. But
sure.
Right, as most politicians do, he stuck his wet finger in the air and saw which way the wind was blowing and made the decision that was best to kind of brush this under the rug and move on from it and use the fact that they saved the Earth as kind of a cover for any violations that they had in service of the Federation, because they broke a lot of rules to do all the things that they did. So yeah, it's an interesting situation. But yes, it's a very sweet ending. I don't mean to shit on it. I'm just more like, it's an interesting.
No, you've ruined Star Trek 4. Thanks a lot, John. Star Trek 4 is no good now.
You know me, I just like to explore all the different ways and still keep the foundation that it's a beautiful ending, but there's all this other stuff that could have been interesting to see, as you said, Steve, leading us into what we would get later.
Well, I'm just going to take your shitting on this one step further. Oh. There's something that came up a bunch of times when we were Scott and I were doing Enterprise incidents, which is that, you know, and this is just dramatic structure, is there are dozens and dozens of times where it's till the last, Kirk makes some crazy gamble.
Yeah.
And in the last possible second, the gamble pays off. And if he had not worked in the last possible second, everyone on the Enterprise, whole planets, all sorts of terrible, terrible things would have happened.
Right.
Is that on each of these cases, you could say, because when you're down to 3, 2, 1, and you defuse the bomb on one, that means if you were 1 second late, everybody died.
Yeah.
Which means that Kirk has essentially gotten lucky over and over and over again and taken a lot of credit for it, when really we don't want any, because most people don't get lucky every single time.
Yeah.
Luck doesn't mean, so we don't want people doing things like Kirk at all. Mostly it ends up terrible.
Yeah.
But for Kirk, it ends up great. And at this moment, Jillian comes up, and Abe, is Kirk maybe flirting with her a little bit?
A little?
What?
A little bit?
Yeah. Wait a minute. Where are you going?
You're going to your ship. I'm going to mine. Science vessel. I got 300 years of catch-up learning to do.
You mean this is goodbye?
Did Kirk really think he was hooking up with Jillian?
Yeah. I think he did.
I think Kirk is an inherently lonely man. And
yeah.
So
oh, wow, yeah.
When he finds someone, and I think this because Kirk is a unique human being. And you just went through a whole great monologue of the things that could have gone wrong if Kirk's guesses didn't work out, right? And he would have not been an extraordinary human being if his guesses hadn't worked out. But because they have, he is an extraordinary human being. And because he is, who he partners up with, the person has to be extraordinary themselves. And so he is always doomed to be a person who never gets the incredible woman to be his partner until, of course, we got to Generations and this Phantom Woman that she's talking about on a horse and whatever.
Oh, like, but like Antonia, whatever.
Yeah. Which I wasn't necessary.
I hate that.
Yeah,
yeah,
I agree with you, Scotty. And so I think he can win at everything else, but he must have some place where he can't win. And even though it doesn't bring in the no-win scenario, believe in the no-win scenario, it is in the personal relationships where he never seems to get the woman that is his partner in life. He always loses out on it. And it's that little bit of tragedy, I think, that helps him to become a person that we kind of subconsciously love for that as well. You know, and I think that's to have her walk away from just like Keeler dying in that episode. It's that kind of little bit of tragedy underneath everything for Kirk.
But he can't. Well, first of all, that's beautifully said. Mm. But you know, this is Jillian looks so perfect in a uniform for a science vessel.
Right?
Yeah,
she is clearly where she belongs.
Yes,
she's in her time with the George and Gracie. And she was always way, way ahead of her time. So now she caught up with the time that she was supposed to be at. And, you know, the mission accomplished. The whales were brought back to the future. The probe was satisfied. Earth is safe. All the starships are getting all their power back. And now Kirk can be like, okay, let's kind of explore our feelings for each other. And she goes, nope, sorry. I'm out of here. I'm on a science vessel.
Why does it have to be goodbye?
Well, like they say in your century, I don't even have your telephone number. How will I find you?
He's totally flirting with her.
Yes.
And she's like, he goes to kiss her. She turns her head, kisses him on the cheek, and whispers in his ear.
See you around the galaxy.
What a great, great line. I think it may not be up there with this line, but it's here's looking at you, kid.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful, beautiful moment. Yeah. And again, just very, I keep going back to this, but I just feel like in there is a similar admiration that Kirk has for Gillian that he also had for Edith.
Yes.
Things and were very different. Yeah, yeah. Things were very different in Sitting on the Edge of Forever.
Yeah.
Very, very, very serious. You know, there was no, there was fish out of water stuff, but it wasn't played to this kind of comic relief. Maybe it was a little bit.
There's some good comedy in City. The stone knives and bear skins and all that stuff.
And the cop, you know, how could your wife let you leave like that? Here, let me help you. But, you know, and the car crossing the spots, just like looking at the car. Hey, look where you're going, will you? Uh-huh. But I do feel like there is a correlation between Gillian Taylor and Edith Keeler.
Yeah, and Carol Marcus. These are the three women that we have seen in Star Trek that he can't quite end up
with. Get over.
Over. Yes, Scott, absolutely. Because there's no mistake. Again, Nimoy knows when to linger with the camera. And after Gillian walks off frame, we are lingering with Kirk's reaction. And he is dumbfounded, for lack of a better term. He is
dumbfounded. What is he thinking?
Yeah.
What is he thinking?
Here we go again. I've lost someone that I could have the potential with to be again. And it's an interesting moment. But then duty calls just a few seconds later. But I like that the camera lingers on him to really kind of process the fact that he can do all of this. He can save a planet, save the galaxy. But he can't quite seem to land the girl. And it's
the right girl. The right girl.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
Well, this is the couple things about this. One is, and it's something, Scott, you and I really discovered, I'll just say that I kind of discovered it, you know, that Kirk has this reputation as the womanizer, but that's really only happens in season 3, you know, of the original series, is that for most of Star Trek, it's actually all the women who are after Kirk. It isn't that he isn't, and yes, he sometimes uses sexuality, you know, in various episodes in order to, you know, complete the mission.
Right.
But mostly the story of Kirk is a story of losing love and tragedy. You know, it isn't about him going after women all the time. And the other thing that occurs to me is there's this thing that's very standard in Hollywood and grew increasingly uncomfortable in the 80s, 90s, and moving up today, which is that beauty standards and casting for men and women are entirely different. And so frequently 50, 60-year-old men are cast in romantic relationships with 25, 30-year-old women. And it's weird, you know, and it gets this weird place. And I think this movie, the way it handles it, walks the tightrope in a really successful way, which is it doesn't say that an older guy can't be attracted to a younger woman. And it doesn't say a younger woman can't be attracted to an older guy, but it doesn't say they end up hooking up either. It just says, yes, there is some attraction here, but we're not going to go anywhere with it, you know?
Well, yeah, because she's a career woman. Remember, this is the 80s. And this is when the Sheena Easton song, Modern Woman, like this is when women were really embracing being a part of the workforce, 9 to 5. So like the having her say, and the nonverbal acting here from her where she lingers staring at him to his responses of like, well, how do I get your phone number? What, is this goodbye? Am I not going to see you again? He's the one that is pleading to be with her and to find a way for them to keep seeing each other. And she lingers for seconds before she responds, trying to find the right response. Because I'm not saying she's friend-zoning him, but for her, this is not the time to settle down. This is not the time to explore a relationship. She's come into the world. She wants to discover all this stuff. Later on down the road is when she'll maybe find someone that she wants to settle down with. But for right now, she's a career woman, and she wants to go and establish herself in her career first, and then she'll figure out love, which I think as you said, Steve, is like they don't have to end up together. But the fact that they have a very touching end to their connection here, I think is a smart approach to the writing that mirrors what was going on in our society with changing gender dynamics.
Spock and Sarek. Again, I feel like this is the resolution of a conflict that we created, that we discussed, the three of us, on Journey to Babel, from the 60s, which is Sarek's disrespect and anger, I would say anger, at Spock's choice to join Starfleet.
I'm returning to Vulcan within the hour. I would like to take my leave of you.
It was most kind of you to make this effort.
It was no effort. You are my son. Besides, I'm most impressed with your performance in this crisis.
This moment is so earned.
Yeah.
It's so earned when you look at the arc of the relationship between Spock and Sarek. Journey to Babel. I mean, really, Journey to Babel, a little in Star Trek 3, but certainly at the beginning of Star Trek 4, and now here at the end, when Sarek says, "Your associates are people of good character." That's a far cry from the disrespect he had for Starfleet, Journey to Babel.
Well, what did you say, Steve, earlier, right? Like, Spock is 55 when he makes this movie. You're 55. Scott's 56. You know, I mean, we're there.
No, right? I'm 56 too. No,
I'm sorry, you're 56. Yeah. So we're all
Scott and I are like a month apart.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's right.
But, like, this is a Sarek who is older. That Sarek from Journey to Babel was a younger, full of piss and vinegar guy who was very clear about what's right and what's wrong and what you should do. This is an older Sarek who's been through the battles and the wars and the negotiations and the diplomacy and seen lives lost because of hard-headed decisions or adherence to a code, possibly. And so seeing how this all ends up, by the way, the way Spock frames it is fantastic, with the two guards, one on each side of Sarek and Spock, and them in the frame center. And they've never looked more father and son than they do in that moment. And I have to tell you, I get emotional or I cry every time when I watch that scene. Not as bad as Field of Dreams, but there's something about watching a character get the approval of their father. And as you said, Journey to Babel, the way that they weave that in by saying, if I recall, it was me who did not like you wanting to be part of the Federation. And then he says, I'm incorrect. And then they have that shot of Spock lifting his eyebrow, right? They use it in the right way, that stereotypical shot of him raising the eyebrow. Because he is surprised that his father admits that he's incorrect about something, which is not something Spock had ever experienced from Sarek, probably ever before. And so there's that real kind of letting down the walls a little bit with each other. And that happens with fathers and sons as they get older. You know, there is a little bit more of the softening of the edges because you're both vulnerable in different ways. And so it's great to see that be an element here and how they wrap up their relationship for now.
So I want to really dig deep into Sarek's line here, because I think this is some beautiful, brilliant writing, and it has so much in it. So first of all, he says, as I recall, I opposed your enlistment in Starfleet.
Yes, as I recall.
Now, this is, from everything we know, the central conflict in Spock and Sarek's life, in which Spock didn't speak to Sarek for decades.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because of this conflict. And so the minimizing by going, like, it's tough. And Sarek remembers everything. So, like, I recall, it's bullshit to begin with.
He's not going to fully admit it. Yeah.
No, exactly. Well, that's what's so great about the line. And then he doesn't say, I was wrong. He says, it is possible that judgment was incorrect.
Well, yeah.
He says, maybe I was wrong.
Yeah. You got to.
That's great. Yeah.
He's going to give, he's never going to fully admit that he was wrong, but he will open the door to the possibility, which is probably as close to an apology as you're ever going to get from Sarek or a Vulcan, you know.
And I think Spock, this version of Spock, understands that and accepts it. Old version of Spock might have argued further. You know what I mean? Like, sure. There might have been more conflict. And then Sarek asks,
do you have a message for your mother?
An amazing plant and payoff.
Yes.
Because I have entirely forgotten. I know no memory of that sequence at the beginning. And Spock says,
yes, tell her I feel fine.
Yeah. Again, an earned moment.
Yeah.
It's bookends the entire film.
Good point.
How do you feel? Yeah. I feel fine. Yeah. And, you know, and everything that happened in between, Spock's ability to answer that question. Live long and prosper, Father. Great moment.
Yep. Yeah. And the fact that Kirk is watching the whole time,
yeah.
I find that to be fascinating as well. I don't think these two gentlemen, if they didn't have the utmost trust and confidence in Kirk, would allow him to witness this interaction between them.
Good point.
So there's something about that that I think is important as well.
And when Spock parts ways with his father and he rejoins Kirk and they both just walk side by side, step in step, with their heads held high, with confidence, like it's everything is happening. Everything good is happening.
Yeah.
Like we did it, you know, I didn't get the girl, but hey, you know, she's here and who knows what will happen, you know, over time, all is good with Spock and his father and his mother. And now, well, Now it's what kind of ship are we going to get here?
And once again, like we were in Motion Picture, like we were in Star Trek II, like we are, you know, we're once again in the shuttle heading to see the ship.
The bureaucratic mentality is the only constant in the universe. We'll get a freighter.
With all respect, Doctor, I'm counting on Excelsior.
I love that they are keeping that going, you know, because when Sulu first sees the Excelsior in Star Trek III, and she's supposed to have transport drive, he's impressed, and he still wants it, and boy, is he going to get it.
And Scotty, of course, is anti-Excelsior.
Excelsior? Why in God's name would you want that bucket of bolts?
A ship is a ship.
Whatever you say, sir, they will be done.
We're sailing through space dock and we're heading towards the Excelsior. And there's this sort of moment of like, oh my God, are we going to get the Excelsior? And I remember, because I loved the design of the Excelsior as a kid. And so I was kind of like, oh, cool, we're going to get the Excelsior. That's awesome. And then we fly over the Excelsior. We hear the theme of the original series. And there is the NCC 1701-A.
I'm telling you. Every single time I watch this movie, I hit the same emotions with the same power at the same moments. And seeing the Enterprise, the primary hull, seeing USS Enterprise, and the camera pans across to NCC 1701-A, and it just brings a smile to my face every time that is punctuated by Kirk's line.
My friends, we've come home.
How they built this whole starship in space dock, and apparently nobody knew about it. It's a bit of a mystery to me. Doesn't matter. Moment's awesome.
Yeah. It is an awesome moment. And the moment, just as you see the Enterprise flying out of space dock and they're all on the bridge at their stations, and you hear the, you know, the sound effect from the original series bridge. Yeah. Like they put that sound effect there. Just gets me every time.
Yep.
Helm ready, Captain.
All right, Mr. Sulu. Let's see what she's got.
It's great line delivery, and we head out, and we go into credits, where we have images of the movie, and I always love little behind-the-scenes stills of the movie, highlighting the characters. I think these are you guys are going to shock that. These are terrible. I don't understand them. They're not, they're just like they picked a bunch of random shots. They're not that great. They're not joyful. Yeah. They're not outtakes. They're not, I don't know. It's weird. It's not one of the credit ones that I like.
For it's me. What they're showing. They're showing stills, but then, you know, once the fanfare of the music kind of settles down into something more melodic, you know, just the image of, you know, seeing Kirk and Spock walk along Marina Boulevard with the Golden Gate Bridge. It's such a beautiful, beautiful moment. I mean, look, I was never the biggest fan of Leonard Rosenman's score for Star Trek IV. I really wished that James Horner would have just finished out his trilogy, but he had already moved on and felt like, you know, Star Trek was kind of beneath him by this point. Even though it had only been a couple of years since Star Trek III, but it's still just this movie is kind of perfect. It really is.
Yeah. I mean, the end shots I think are done on purpose to evoke the TV show. Cause this is the end shots you would see in a TV show.
Oh, that's an interesting point.
Well, that's that's kind of how I've
You're right.
Oh, no, that's a great point.
I mean, this again, I feel like if I remember correctly, and again, we're all three of us around the same age. So like, if I remember correctly, there was this feeling that this could be the last one. And so going, you know, once again, evoking one of the best episodes of the original series by having them go back in time to the 20th century is a great way to kind of appeal to all the fans. And then also as a meta way of saying to the people in the current 20th century, this is what it would be like if these people came back into our time. So there's a sense of breaking down the wall there. And then the way that they end the film with everything being resolved, all the lingering storylines are wrapped up, except obviously the Klingon stuff, which I mentioned earlier, which we've come back to on 6. And then at the end, having these clips play throughout, it just feels like they were possibly saying goodbye by evoking all the stuff that you've come to know about the Star Trek TV show and the Star Trek series overall. So That's the way.
That's a really, really great point. Yeah. John, I never thought about it, but yeah, every episode ends with the, you know, stills from the episode we just saw or stills from other episodes. Right. I remember when I was a kid just watching Star Trek for the first time, and you got to the end of the second season episodes when you're watching the credits and you see that image of Baylock. I saw that. Yep. That scared the hell out of me as a kid. Like, I'm like, what the hell is that? So, you know, by the time I started watching Star Trek, and I remember vividly that it was during the second season, because it was like, you know, Mirror Mirror and all that. So, you know, you get to the end of the credits and you see the Baylock image. But by that point, I still hadn't seen the Corbomite maneuver. So I had no idea what that was. But that
still
a great
boggles
point
my mind.
Back.
It still boggles my mind that you can remember what order you watched the original series in when you were 7 years old.
Seven. I'm telling you, man, it just made that much of an impact. Of course, you're talking to somebody who has an affinity for movie release dates.
Right.
So, you know, come on, guys. You know this.
We all got our things. Absolutely. So, yeah, for sure.
The movie opened on November 26th, 1986. Mm. So less than a month later, on December 20th, one of the great moments of Star Trek fandom, for better or worse, happened. That moment, my friends, is when William Shatner hosted Saturday Night Live.
Classic episode.
I remember it was obviously, you know, late at night on a Saturday, December 20th, 1986, and I was sitting up with my parents watching Saturday Night Live. I was all excited that William Shatner was hosting because I had already seen Star Trek IV a few times. And he does the Get a Life skit.
I love that skit.
That Get a Life skit is still the funniest, most cringe-inducing skit, but laugh-out-loud funniest Saturday Night Live moment I think I have ever seen.
You know, before I answer any more questions, there's something I wanted to say. I having received all your letters over the years, and I've spoken to many of you, and some of you have traveled, you know, hundreds of miles to be here, I'd just like to say, get a life, will you, people?
And everyone in the audience applauded and whooped and hollered.
Yeah.
And he says to, I think it's...
Oh, is it
John Lovitz?
John
Lovitz. Yeah. He's wearing a blue Ike Rock Spock shirt, and he's wearing ears, and he says, "You, have you ever kissed a girl?" And he looks down like ashamed. But the moment that I remember about this is, so, you know, the convention promoter goes up to him, and they get into a shoving match, and Shatner goes back to the microphone. He goes,
"Of course, that speech was a recreation of the evil Captain Kirk." From episode 37.
And I turned around to my parents and I said, "The Enemy Within is episode number 5. And my dad went, "Touché."
I'm glad you brought this up, Scott, because there's a weird thing about this. This is obviously a very, very famous sketch, but it's also, what's weird about it is that it is ostensibly insulting nerds, right? Like, that is the whole point. And yet, as a nerd,
making fun of them. It's not, I don't know if it's insulting. It's more making,
I mean,
fun
saying, get a life, have you ever kissed a girl, is not
it's an SNL thing. If it was done like a serious approach,
get out of your parents' basement.
Right. I think I agree. If it was on a serious show, it's like, if it was Shatner on, like, I don't know, on Charlie Rose's show or someone's like, these people need to get a life. And if they even kiss girls, then that's insulting. I think this is done under the auspices of, like, taking the piss out of something. Yeah.
I totally agree. I mean, it is making fun of people, but in a way, for me as a nerd, and it sounds like, Scott, for you too, what the result of it was actually to feel totally seen. You know what I mean?
Totally. Probably. Like, yeah. Yeah.
Like, you kind of go,
like a badge of honor. It like was a badge of honor that he was, like, talking to us.
And what's so weird is that, at that time, nerds were like, nerds was not cool. And so no, you were socially awkward. And it wasn't just that the things you were into weren't cool. Yeah. That's certainly true. But it was also you weren't cool. You know, right. That's where have you ever kissed a girl thing came, you know, comes from. And that now we've gotten to this weird place where all the nerd stuff is totally mainstream. And if anything, they're more obsessive and angry about all these little details. And I will say to some of that community right now, get a life, you know?
No, I mean, clearly now, like with all the Star Wars shows and all the Star Trek shows and all the Marvel stuff and the DC stuff, you know, everyone that, you know, all of that is cool. But, you know, when we were, you know, growing up in the 70s and the 80s, it definitely was not cool at all.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the thing. Yeah. And so I love that sketch because in the end, Shatner is wrong. Right. And this was also the time when Shatner wanted to stop doing this stuff because if I remember correctly, he was like so typecast with this. This was his way of like trying to get a little bit of a passive aggressive shot out across the bow. But in the sketch, he is in the wrong for doing what he did. Because as you said, Scott, it's Phil Hartman who comes up there as the concert promoter or convention promoter and like goes at him and pushes him and shoves him, which I think is great. And then he comes back and apologizes. All right, said Phaser's the stun. And it's so hilarious. But then later, people forget these two other sketches. The Wrath of Khan sketch is genius when Dana Carvey plays Khan, which I think because they've turned the Enterprise into a floating lunch
That's right.
Genius. And then the him with the Sweeney sisters, I think, is an incredible sketch as well. So that episode, yes, that one sketch stands out. And you're so right to bring it up, Scott. But I think that entire episode is one of the best episodes of like 1980s SNL ever, because Shatner was so good at rolling with the punches and playing comedic beats with all of the people on the cast.
So John, are you saying that we should focus on the movies? It's hilarious. Oh my God, it's still hilarious.
Sulu.
So also what happened?
Yes.
Also what happened about a year after Star Trek IV opened is that the Voyage Home became the very first Star Trek film to be shown in the Soviet Union as it was screened by the World Wildlife Federation to celebrate the country's ban on whaling.
Oh, wow. Great.
And as for what a couple of major cast members thought of Star Trek IV, William Shatner said, "I was a little concerned it might be too much of a romp, but Leonard had a clear vision and he pulled it off beautifully. It was the most successful of all the Star Trek movies that I was in, and it was fun to do. None of us expected it to become such a phenomenon. It was a happy accident, but a very smart and well-crafted one." And then I end with Leonard Nimoy, who said, "We had a great time making it. The cast loved the script. We shot a lot on location, especially in San Francisco, and the energy was just terrific. It reached people in a way the other movies didn't."
That's awesome.
Yeah.
It was nominated for a few Academy Awards, sound, music, special effects. It didn't win them. It obviously was a huge hit, the most successful Star Trek movie ever, I think, Scott, isn't it?
It was the most successful Star Trek movie up until Star Trek 2009.
Right. Mm.
You know, that really like kicked the door open, even though I have to say, no Star Trek film has ever made more than $500 million worldwide.
Oh, wow.
You know, you have all these. Yeah, isn't it wild? I mean, like you have like all the Pixar movies, certainly the Avengers movies, the Star Wars movies that make more than $1 billion. And yet the highest grossing Star Trek feature is Star Trek Into Darkness from 2013, which is like $480 million worldwide. But for its time, and also the Star Trek films from like the original series and the Next Generation, they never played overseas. I mean, they played overseas, but they didn't like, it wasn't like today where movies make 2/3 of their total gross from overseas. Mm. Right. But Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home was the highest grossing Star Trek feature of the first 10 movies with $109.7 million domestic.
Can I give you one more success story from the film Star Trek IV? Well, initially, humpback whale populations in the world pre-hunting was around 125,000 humpback whales. Mm. By the 60s, that number was down to 10,000. Oh, wow. So we had hunted, when Jillian is saying we are hunting them almost to extinction, that is definitely true. Today, the global population is back up around 80,000. Wow. So we are not back to pre-industrial age, but 8 times the recovery. I mean, that is an incredible thing. And while I will not give Star Trek IV the full responsibility for that, I think it's an important moment because humanizing the animals and seeing them and telling this story about them makes a big difference in terms of how we perceive that part of our nature.
Well, that's why it always frustrates me when people try to denigrate the power of movies and it's not that important, or the arts or whatever. But like, man, the arts, movies, these are so important. And you have to be aware of their importance in our society and how they affect our society. And sometimes they're the things that drive and inspire the people in our society to do amazing things in our society because at a young age they saw something in a movie that moved them, touched them, affected them, educated them. And so when that stuff happens as a result of a film coming out, I think that's something that should be applauded, honestly.
Absolutely, for sure.
100%. So I will give my final thoughts first on Star Trek IV. I'm so glad we did this, guys. I just, you know, and my feeling about our conversation is like my feeling about the movie, which is that it's just a joy. Is this a deep film? No. Is it an incredibly intricate, complicated film? No. It is spending time with characters I love, where they're in character, doing what I want them to do in my own world, my own city that I grew up right across the bay from. It is, and it delivers on every single thing it sets out to do. Like, is it my favorite Star Trek film? No. Is it an absolute and total joy? Absolutely. It totally is. John, how about you?
Here's my final thoughts. I'm also very happy we did this. And, you know, sometimes in our scheduling, we're not always sure where we're going to go or what we're going to do next. And this was a happy little accident where there was a pocket of time that opened up for us because of a scheduling situation. And we decided to do this movie. And at a time when so much is happening in our world that makes people feel uncomfortable, overwhelmed, or scared, it's great to revisit the films that made you smile, made you cry, made you feel hopeful about the world and the possibilities for the human race. And I think this film does that. And you've got an incredible crew to enjoy and savor in a Star Trek adventure. And so I'm glad we did it. And honestly, I loved hearing from both of you what you guys thought about scenes that I had seen over a million times in my life. Of course, I'm exaggerating, but clearly it feels that way. And get a whole new appreciation and perspective for it all, and appreciate Leonard Nimoy's directorial work and the performances within this movie, which I haven't always given enough credit to with the other characters besides the main three. So I really appreciated revisiting it for that situation alone. You know, so yeah, great stuff, man. Thank you, gentlemen.
Yeah, I've seen this movie more times than I can count, but a million times is probably pretty accurate there, John. And, you know, over these years, people have referred to Star Trek IV as the one with the whales, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And as soon as somebody says that, you go, oh, yeah, The Voyage Home, you know? And when you say that, when you feel it, when you hear those words, the one with the whales, it gives you a good feeling. Because this movie is a good feeling.
Yeah.
It is a good feeling, especially now, because we really need a good feeling now. But it was such an optimistic look at what we can do to ensure a better future, which is what we need a whole lot more now than we did in 1986. Mm. But still, the way that, you know, Star Trek was intended to be an allegory for mirroring the times, and the original series definitely did that. Not every episode, but certainly a lot of the better ones.
Yeah.
And here you have a movie that's a little more on the nose than an allegory, but it does what it does so exceptionally well.
Yeah.
Because it's true to the characters, it's playing to their strengths and their weaknesses for comic relief. Certainly the familiarity that the actors have working together and the chemistry that they all have, especially Shatner, Nimoy, and D. Kelly.
Yeah.
And just in the way that it ties into how communication was just such a big, big part of solving problems in the original series and they made communication the key to saving the day and the voyage home. But it was such an uplifting, feel-good movie. And to swatch it again, because it has been a while since I'd seen it, that it's just good. It's a good feeling movie. Nimoy said when it came to his approach to capturing all the feels for this movie, he wanted, quote, no dying, no fighting, no shooting, no photon torpedoes, no phaser blasts, no stereotypical bad guy. Things that have been, end quote, by the way, things that have, been played to the fore for certainly Star Trek II and some of the episodes like Doomsday Machine. But here was a deliberate approach to stay away from all of that. And you got one of the very, very best Star Trek, not just movies, but Star Trek stories, period.
Yeah.
And this is a film that it's easy to see why people who didn't like Star Trek or had never watched Star Trek liked the movie. It didn't matter. It was just time travelers out of time trying to save something that we all know about. I mean, everybody knew about whale hunting then and now, but it was such a pleasure to join you for three parts and to see Star Trek IV in a completely different light and to tie it back to some of the themes we explored in the original series during Enterprise incidents and to have a revelation, an epiphany about Gillian Taylor being Star Trek IV's version of Edith Keeler in some ways. Not something I ever thought about before, but the more we talked through that, the more it made such great sense. So thank you, gentlemen, for such a rewarding three-part conversation on Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home.
Thank you. And to everyone listening, we'd love to hear your thoughts. You can visit us on our Facebook page. Just do a search for The Cinephiles. It's Cine_Files on Twitter, The Cinephiles Podcast on Instagram. You can also subscribe to the show at all the places where you can get podcasts, along with Enterprise Incidents with Scott and Steve. And why don't we subscribe to The Geek Buddies and The Hot Mic and every other, and Spill the Tequila and any other podcast that the three of us are involved in while you're at it. Please leave your comments or your reviews. They're very helpful. If you want to buy or stream Star Trek IV, along with every other film we've ever reviewed, it's at cinephiles.net. And you can support the show at patreon.com/thecinephiles, where you can get ad-free versions of the show, our Cinephile shorts. Those are also available on Apple Podcasts. And if you want to reach me, SR Morris on Twitter, SR Morris 1 on Instagram. John, how would they reach you?
You can always reach me at The Rooka Says on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, Threads, and Blue Sky that I'm out there on as well. And of course, as Steve mentioned, the YouTube channel that I host that I now is the John Rocha channel. By the time you guys hear this part, it will be the John Rocha channel. We're moving away from the outlaw stuff, but come and hang out with us. Same outlaw energy, new name there, youtube.com/John Rocha Says. Thank you, gentlemen.
And Mr. Mance, how would folks find you?
Well, you can certainly find me all over social media, TikTok, Instagram, formerly Twitter. If you care to go there, I certainly understand if you don't, at Movie Mance. But what would really, really make me super, super happy is if you would go to Enterprise Incidents with Scott and Steve, go to our Facebook page, go to Apple Podcasts, Spotify. If you have not yet heard Enterprise Incidents and you've been listening to this three-part conversation on The Voyage Home, then you are going to love what we did with each and every episode of the original series and the animated series from 1973, which won an Emmy. Do so. It's Enterprise Incidents with Scott and Steve. So please give that a listen and let us know what you think.
And if you do subscribe to Enterprise Incidents with Scott and Steve, at some point, I believe that show will return for a little movie called Star Trek V, The Final Frontier.
And that will be a very interesting conversation.
So I think that is it for this week. We will be back next time, which, John, I'm just going to announce it. We're going back to 1978.
Yes.
With our special guest, Michael Vogel, to discuss the original Superman, the movie.
Oh, man, that sounds awesome. But until then, keep going boldly.
If you're a podcast host, listen up. This one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.